From WGN Radio Chicago, it's time now for Extension 720. Here now is your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
My guests tonight are all of them very interested in politics and politicians. As it happens, on the side, they also draw pictures about such people. Pictures isn't the right word. They draw great political cartoons. They are Herbert Block, Herb Block of the Washington Post, Jack Higgins of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Dick Locher of the Chicago Tribune. Gentlemen, say hello.
Hello out there.
Hello.
Hello.
Just to establish that you're here. Now I want to read you a long quotation, and I want to know how you respond to it. Here's a guy who knew a good deal about politicians, one of the great politicians of the 19th century, none other than Benjamin Disraeli, a Prime Minister of England, who says, in his definition of politicians, a sophistical rhetorician, inebriated with the exuberance of his own verbosity, and gifted with an egotistical imagination that can at all times command an interminable and inconsistent series of arguments to malign an opponent and to glorify himself. Does that hold for most of the politicians you've known?
I don't know about that. Sounds as if Disraeli was pretty running on pretty much himself there.
or Gladstone, who was his eternal enemy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Another definition. Idealism is the noble toga that political gentlemen drape over their will to power. That's Aldous Huxley. Or one last quotation from Pamela Hansford Johnson. These are all English in origin, but I think English and American politicians have something in common. She says, you slam a politician, you make out he's a devil with horns and hoofs, but his wife loves him, and so did all his mistresses.
That's probably the most accurate one, right? Yeah,
you think so?
I'd still rather work with pictures.
Yeah, the pictures. Yeah, we can do it with pictures.
You'd rather skewer them with pictures than with words.
Yeah, yeah. You know. For example, what did it take you to read that? 15 seconds, perhaps. Uh-huh. You know, we get 6 seconds.
Of attention, of visual attention.
Yeah. And it's worth 1,000 words. You just can't print those words. Those are pretty words he has there, but we can get across the point a lot quicker.
And the visual image is more lasting, in a way.
Oh, yeah. The mind remembers pictures.
Who can ever forget Herb Block's treatment of Richard Nixon?
Oh, God, with the beard.
And even before that, of coming out of the image of coming out of the sewer. How often did you use that?
Well, I only did that once, really, with Nixon. That was during his 1954 campaign when he was traveling around the country. He was vice president, and he was the hatchet man for the administration. He was traveling around the country, you know, implying that the Democratic congressmen and senators were all communists or sympathizers. And I thought to myself, this guy's traveling around the country by sewer. And I thought, why not draw it? You know? And so I had him at a band in the background waiting to welcome him, and somebody saying, hey, here he is now, and he's lifting up the sewer lid and coming up. Later on, I had Agnew doing the same thing, and Nixon telling him how to do it.
Great image.
Yeah. Great image.
Yeah. And it really doesn't need words.
No, but the two of them, interesting, Nixon and Agnew, two of them had to resign in disgrace, you know.
And then, of course, for both Nixon and also for Joe McCarthy, you made a great deal of the 5 o'clock shadow on the face.
Yeah. Well, because actually they had the 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah.
And you can look in photographs and they had it. But, you know, if I thought they were noble guys, they could have left it off. You guys, I'm sure, do the same thing. But, you know, the caricature.
Sound like Disraeli, isn't
it? Yeah. No, but the caricature is an opinion thing, too, don't you think? You know,
absolutely,
the way we draw these guys.
Sure, you can make them look angelic.
Yeah, well, for example, don't you think Reagan, for example, I thought that a lot of things he did were awfully wrong. He said things that he knew weren't so and so on, but you couldn't make him out to be a thug. You know, he didn't.
It's interesting how the various presidents whom you bothered because you treated them with less than absolute love and admiration, some of them got very angry. Eisenhower canceled the subscription to the Washington Post and so on. But Reagan merely was heard to kind of whine or mumble or otherwise complain, I think he just doesn't like me. That about you?
Yeah, he said that. You know, somebody worked with him told me that one morning he looked at the cartoon and slammed it down and said, that guy just doesn't like me. But I think
that's
Reagan,
sort of a winning response in a way, isn't it?
Well,
compared to some of the others.
Yeah, but I think Reagan felt that everything was a personal, likable thing. He was probably a very likable guy, and I don't think it occurred to him it was his policies that somebody might be criticizing.
I wonder how many mayors and or others in City Hall in Chicago say about Jack Higgins, I think maybe he just doesn't like me.
I don't know. They don't talk to me. They'll talk to the editors. They'll talk to reporters. I'll sometimes hear.
They call up and shout at editors.
Well, what I'll usually hear is from some guy that works in the government for the mayor, who will say, "Boy, he went through the roof twice last week."
Uh-huh.
And that's usually how it comes down. One time I got it directly from the mayor, from another guy who had been out with the mayor that day, and he was supposed to tour around the city with the mayor. And by the end of the day, or by the end of this ride around the city, the mayor clearly was ignoring him. And finally he dropped him off in front of City Hall, and when the mayor let him out of the car, he says, "Well, have you got anything to say?" And he said, "Yeah, tell Jack Higgins to drop dead." And apparently it was some cartoon I had drawn that day that the guy hadn't seen, that the reporter hadn't seen, went and checked it, and realized that the mayor was
shooting
at him.
You really know how to hurt a guy, apparently. It may be that in your art, that's something that you've got available. The picture is the best stiletto of all.
Yeah, you can have the message, but then the picture comes along with it, and that's what really does it. Yeah. You can show him overweight or with a beard or whatever you want. Yeah. Remember Daly's father? Uh-huh. He says, "I have been vilified, and I have been castigated, and yes, even criticized."
And even criticized. That's great.
So, there's a sensitivity there, and I think that's great.
On the other hand, there's some of these guys who whatever is said about them or drawn about them, they want the copy of it because it's about them. They collect things.
Don't you think guys, too? Don't you think that's a ruse on their part?
Well, I don't know. I think some of them like to collect things. I mentioned in the book, if I can mention this, one of the worst was J. Parnell Thomas of the Committee on Un-American Activities, who later went to jail for accepting kickbacks. And he used to write in and ask for copies of the cartoons about him. None of them were favorable. They were terrible. Anyhow, and the editor of the Washington Post at the time was a guy named Casey Jones, who lived next door to him. And he kept saying, "Hey, why don't you send something to Thomas?" Finally, one day he came in. He said, "Geez, they took Thomas to the hospital today." And he says, "For Christ's sake, send that guy something." He says, "The last thing they said is they put him in the ambulance. Tell Herb to send me one of those."
He probably had his jail cell plastered with Herb Lock cartoons about himself.
I think another aspect of it is they want to get him out of circulation.
Yeah, right.
We've got to stop for some commercials. We're going to do that rather often tonight. And then I want to talk about the career of Herb Lock. Who started his life and his career, indeed, right here in Chicago. Your first cartooning job was for the Chicago Daily News.
Daily News. Well, before that, I'd done some stuff for a paper called the Evanston News Index, a suburban paper.
It's interesting, that's a parallel to Jack Higgins' career and the beginnings of his career somewhat more recently. Your first published cartoons were for the
Daily Northwestern.
For the Daily Northwestern.
And then
also up in Evanston.
Yeah, and I started doing sports caricatures and for the Daily News. While I was up there, and then that folded, and I started freelancing with the Sun-Times. So,
You would all agree with me. Well, I'm not going to ask Herb whether he agrees with me, but Jack Higgins and Dick Locher would agree with me that with us tonight as the third man on this panel is the dean of American political cartooning, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We want to learn more about that life. It is given in an excellent new autobiography titled Herb Lock, A Cartoonist's Life. But I'd like to hear what two other Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonists have to say about Herb Lock, who won the Pulitzer Prize four times. Whereas you guys each won it only once, or Dick, did you win it twice?
No, once.
Yeah. Once.
Well, you're pikers compared to
pikers. Absolutely pikers.
We'll be right back
after
we pause for these words.
From WGN Radio Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Once again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to a collection of three of the best political cartoonists in the country. They are Dick Locher of the Tribune, Jack Higgins of the Sun-Times, and Herb Lock of the Washington Post. But you see Herb Lock all over the place. Are your cartoons actually syndicated, or do they just wind up in the New York Times on Sunday?
No, they're syndicated, and they appear in the Chicago Sun-Times from time to time.
Like today.
A lot.
Was it today?
Mm-hmm. So you and Jack alternate, really?
They have these editorial pages, op-ed pages,
Yeah.
I
want to talk about the distinctive style and also about the significant history of the Dean of American Political Cartooning. And I'll turn to Dick Locher to begin to give us a fill-in.
Herb, for crying out loud, the first cartoon I ever saw that you drew, they passed a yellowed copy around the editorial board of the Tribune one day. And we were all admiring it. And they said, "Yeah, Herb was from Chicago, wasn't he?" And they said, "Yeah." I looked at the date on that darn thing, and it was 1934. Yeah. And that was this year that we passed that thing around.
Do you remember the cartoon itself?
Yeah, the cartoon itself. How long have you been doing it, really?
Well, I began doing daily cartoons for the Chicago News in 1929.
29, really?
29, yeah.
Is that right?
Herbert Hoover was president.
Good grief.
Yeah.
How many presidents then?
12. 12. The beginning.
Every one of them knows Herb.
I don't know about Hoover.
No, but
then you're a little bit older than 15.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I think that's an accurate way of putting it.
Indeed, your book makes clear you're in your early 80s.
That's right.
Yes. And still going strong. You do a daily cartoon, do you, for the Times?
For the Washington Post.
The Times is that other newspaper
in
Washington.
Well, there is a Washington Times.
I know, the Mooney newspaper. Yeah,
yeah, the Mooney. But I read the New York Times.
Sure. But you do a cartoon almost every day.
Yeah, I do four a week now.
Four a week.
That's what I've been doing.
You started for the Daily News, then you wound up in Cleveland, Ohio,
for an outfit called Newspaper Enterprise Association, NEA Service, which was the Scripps Howard Feature Service. And, you know, it was a little better deal for me because I was second banana on the Chicago News. Von Shoemaker was there.
Oh, Shoemaker was there?
He was their main guy. And I filled in for him once in a while, but I had a little two-column thing on the editorial page, and they syndicated that. Well, anyhow, the Cleveland thing seemed like a better deal. They claimed they had 700 papers. You know, mostly small papers have got the whole works, you know, sports, movies, editorials, but in six other things for about $5, $10 a week than during a depression. But anyhow, I was there for 10 years, and I went in the Army and was there for about 3 years, and then I moved to Washington.
You did the war?
I did. Well, I didn't really win the war.
What did you do in the Great what did you do in the Great War, Daddy?
Geez, I was always afraid somebody might ask that question. Yeah. Well, what they did was an editor who had a public relations office in Florida, you know, had used my stuff in his paper and heard I went in and said he put in for me to go down there. And then they sent me up to New York where I was editor of a clip sheet, which went out to Army papers, and I did cartoons and wrote articles for it. And when I say I was editor, I mean I had a staff that I had under me, a guy that had only one stripe, and I had two stripes. So that was my staff. That was power.
That's power.
A corporal does rank a private.
No, did you know Bill Mauldin?
I did, but not till afterward. Yeah.
Afterward. Oh.
Yeah. Well, who were the very active cartoonists in the military publications during the war? You were, and Mauldin was.
Milt Caniff did
Milton Caniff.
A great strip.
Uh-huh.
Who did Sad Sack?
Sad Sack was...
Baker?
Was it Baker? Yeah. Gee, he was very funny.
Was that in one of the Army publications, or was that only
Yank.
After the war?
That was in Yank.
Oh, no, that was during the war.
And as an example, I remember one of his Sad Sack things was where he sees a training film about sex, you know, venereal disease and on.
Yeah.
And he goes out and he meets a girl and he puts on a rubber glove to shake hands with her. You know.
He was way ahead of his time.
Oh, he was. You know, this is still an issue. He was a very funny guy.
He had one other classic one.
Yeah.
Sad Sack was reading the bulletin board. And it was KP duty and who was on guard duty and all that. And he kept, and his name wasn't on the front sheet, so he kept flipping through them. And he's underneath all of these papers. And he's holding up his cigarette lighter to read, and the one at the very bottom said, "There will be a crossing of the Delaware," signed G. Washington.
Oh, gee.
You know, I got to double back for a moment to Sad Sack seeing the film about the dangers of venereal disease.
Yeah.
I happen to know something about that. Did you know that there was follow-up research done by the Information and Education Division of the Army, a special propaganda outfit in the Army, or rather in the War Department itself, during the war, in which they tested the efficacy of that film, very simply, by going, they showed it in some camps and didn't show it in other camps. Then they checked the venereal disease rate for the following 6 months. And the venereal disease rate was higher for soldiers in the camps where they showed the film regularly
right?
and for camps where they didn't.
Is that right?
It's a famous research study published in the American Soldier series, edited by Samuel Stauffer. One of my professors, Carl Hovland, was one of the researchers on all of that. Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's a well-known social scientific study, so demonstrating that propaganda doesn't necessarily work the way you expect it's going to.
Yeah. The guys who saw the film went back thinking, sex, sex, sex.
Apparently so. Apparently so. Yeah, exactly. You've all skewered all sorts of public figures. You've occasionally probably paid them compliments, too. But when it comes to American presidents, who was the first president on whose case you got?
Well, let's see.
Herbert Hoover himself?
Yeah, I did some about Hoover. I wouldn't say they were tough. The stuff I was doing for the Chicago News was a pretty light editorial cartoon.
Did you ever make any trouble for Roosevelt, or were you too fond of
him? No, I think I did some stuff kind of kidding some of the alphabet agencies or the stuff about the Supreme Court packing thing. Mm-hmm. They were not too tough. I thought Roosevelt was a good president, and I thought Truman was great. But they've all come in for criticism one time or another. I think all of us have, don't you? Whoever is
I don't
is
think
in
anybody escapes.
I don't think anybody does. And even if you think the president is doing a good job, you know, there'd be something you think they could do more of,
exactly.
or the guys in Congress that are opposing him, you know.
Yeah. To get to agitate. You have to agitate.
Yeah. But Herb, the first one you really landed on with any real heaviness was, I gather, Eisenhower. Is that right?
Yeah, Eisenhower, I guess so. I didn't feel that I'd landed on him too much, but there were two things. You know, he was a tremendously popular president, a war hero, naturally, and all that. But he, two of the great issues that concerned me were, one was McCarthyism, and I didn't think he was good on that. And, you know, I think he waited to be attacked almost personally. And the other one was desegregation, where I think he actually lobbied some of the Supreme Court justices to, you know, go easy before the Brown versus Board of Education thing, and talked about you can't change the hearts of men. And gee, in the meantime, this massive resistance campaign built up, and it was 3 years before he sent troops to Little Rock only to prevent rioting. You know? And I thought those were two very important domestic issues. I didn't think he was good on them.
You know, you mentioned McCarthy and McCarthyism.
Yeah.
About 2 weeks ago, Margaret Thatcher was here, and one point I made to her was there is a general governmental philosophy known as Thatcherism, but there isn't any ism named for any of your predecessors. And how do you account for that? I mean, that's just a way of getting into something. And it occurs to me that McCarthyism, I learned from your book, Herb Locke, A Cartoonist's Life, is a designation of a spirit that was abroad in the land, and you're responsible for that designation, apparently.
Yeah, but only by accident, really. I had this tower of tar barrels that some of the Republicans wanted the elephant to stand on, and, you know, what do you label the thing? And it isn't McCarthy himself, and you say, McCarthy tactics, you know, yuck.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, McCarthyism, and, you know,
it's a great cartoon. It's reproduced in this book, as are some 200 cartoons, and I'm looking for it right now, but I can't find it. But there's another McCarthy cartoon, which I'm handing at the moment to Jack Higgins, and he can describe it and give us an artist's appreciation of it.
This one I'm a little bit unfamiliar with. Maybe you can help me.
This is McCarthy holding in his... He's got in one hand a fake letter, in another hand a doctored photo, which he used both of these things in fake numbers, and they're kind of burning, going up in smoke, and kind of burning him, burning his fingers, and he's saying... This favorite expression of his, I have here in my hand, because he started off saying, I have here in my hand, names of 205 communists in the State Department, that kind of thing.
You do a pretty good imitation, sound-wise, too.
He had this metallic voice, though.
He did.
It was really kind of frightening, you know?
It was metallic. But these are Blockisms, aren't they?
Did you go after McCarthy, or is that a little bit before your time, Dave?
No, I didn't have a chance, no. Nixon was the first one.
Nixon is the first man you went after in a serious way?
Yeah.
What do you remember doing to Richard Nixon?
Well, you know, he ended the Vietnam War in 74. Mm-hmm. And then we had a convention in Washington at that time, and we were supposed to have our convention at the Watergate, but it was booked. We couldn't get in. And the convention was at the exact same time as the break-in. And, of course, the Washington Post came out with the headlines, break-in at the Watergate. And, you know, the cartoonist says, we didn't do it. We weren't there. But after that, the floodgates opened up, and we had a lot of fun with that. I mean, you couldn't give a cartoonist a better a subject than Watergate. No. It was an incredible thing. And then, of course, Agnew, he was another co-pilot of this whole scenario.
What are some of the great Watergate cartoons, whether done by somebody at this table or by anybody else?
I had, you know, Nixon and the tapes.
Yeah.
You know, the missing segment, the 13... was it
18 and a half minute gap.
18 and a half minute gap. And they asked Rose... I did a cartoon, and Rosemary Wood was in court. Said, could you tell us, could you do the 18 and a half minute gap? And she says, well, if you give me the words, I'll see if I can hum. That's just one I had to remember. And then there was the one of Nixon standing on the stop button of a portable recorder.
Oh, yeah.
And who was the judge?
Sirica.
Sirica was jumping up and down on the play button. Nixon standing there with his hands folded. And you know, these were the type of cartoons that were image, just images, and probably not a great message, but the image was there. And,
there's a cartoon in here. We're making it hard for poor old Richard Nixon. But there's a cartoon by Herb, which is reproduced in Herb Locke, A Cartoonist's Life. Did I say that's published by Macmillan? If not, I've now said it. Where you play with his famous statement down in Disneyland to the provincial editors. What was it? I am not a crook, or your president is not a crook?
Yeah, he said, you have a right to know whether your president is a crook. Well, I am not a crook. And the cartoon shows him hanging between two tapes, which at the time of that gap you were talking about, Dick, and on one side it says, I am, and on the other side, a crook. And in his mouth, he's got the word not.
He's hanging there by the skin of his teeth, also.
Yeah. There was also the famous, Nixon's the one. Remember they were using
that they used that for a slogan.
That was the slogan,
And he walked into the Hilton down here in Chicago, and there's a pregnant woman standing there.
Oh,
she's holding the sign.
Was that a cartoon or really
That really happened.
Oh, God. That
was a photo.
Oh, that's great. And Dick Tuckman probably thought of that.
Somebody set that up, by the way.
I bet that was set up, but Nixon got a kick out of him. He actually laughed. Right. And you don't see many pictures of Nixon laughing.
Uh-huh.
But that was one.
That speaks well for him that he laughed at that.
Really.
We've got some commercials again. Does that amuse you? If so, now's the time to laugh. and then we will be directly back to Herb Locke, to Jack Higgins, and to Dick Locher after these words.
This is WGN Radio Chicago, and you're listening to Extension 720. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Jack Higgins, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist for the Chicago Sun-Times, Dick Locher, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, and Herb Locke, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, and Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist for the Washington Post.
I'm glad he's in Chicago.
To the fourth power.
To the fourth power. I could have just said Pulitzer to the fourth, yeah. I want you to, you're looking at some of each other's work, and I want to choose a few examples and have you analyze the particular cartoons in hand and why they work so well. Not your own, obviously, but somebody else's at this table. Dick Locher, you can begin.
I've got one of Jack's here that it's really one of my favorite subjects right now, and I think it's on the minds of a lot of people, is Ross Perot. And it shows, Jack has done this graphically beautiful. It shows a sink with a hole in the bottom, and the hole is the O in Perot. It's P-E-R, and then this sink, the hole in the bottom, and then a T, and down below it says that giant sucking sound.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's a good subject, and it's a good cartoon.
Was that right after that debate with Al Gore?
Yeah, I drew it the next day.
Was your way of saying that Perot made a fool of himself in the debate.
Oh, yeah. I think people all over America were just watching him, and they were hearing him whine, and while they're listening to him whine, they're just hearing a sucking sound.
So that's what you think. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
That you think that.
And holds up a graph. That was so bad. Really, that was so bad. But Clinton came out the winner.
Yeah. Now, think about what Jack did there. Because you didn't do that when he did it. You admire it, and I see why you would. You need the key to a good political cartoon, apart from a clear political idea and apart from good craftsmanship or draftsmanship or whatever you guys call it, being able to draw well. The key is some kind of symbolization, some way of representing the general in the through the particular or the concrete.
Exactly. A symbol, a metaphor.
Like and Perot brought it on himself.
Yeah, brought it on himself. Exactly. He's the one going down the tubes. Yeah.
But you're picking up there on something he used a great deal.
Yeah, sometimes it helps just to go and use with a familiar motif that they present themselves.
Yeah.
If you can go and use their own words or actions against them.
And he's used that great sucking sound is what, Jobs Going South, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, many times. That giant sucking sound you hear is Jobs Going South across the border. Using that or using his charts against him or whatever, turnaround is fair play. To use a guy's own words or actions and to go and skewer him with
I am not a crook.
Like I am not a crook, Herb did.
Yeah, turn it right against him. Well, Clinton, too, with his saxophone.
What about his saxophone?
He didn't inhale.
Did you do that?
I did.
That sounds familiar. I think I saw that one.
He said, Albert Gore says, we're not blowing smoke. And he said, no, of course not. We're not inhaling either. But you can. Like Jack says, they say the words and then we turn them around.
Yeah.
But it's done with a picture, too. And the beauty of it is you get 6 seconds to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that before, but I'm not sure. it's only 6 seconds. When I see a good cartoon, I will, by any one of the three of you, and I've admired the work of each of you separately, I will sometimes linger over it.
Well, I like to hear you say that.
Well,
because,
of course one does.
Well, if it's a good one, I'm sure it's like us reading a column. You know, you languish with it and enjoy it.
People don't realize that even though they can see it in 6 seconds, it actually takes us 10 or 15 seconds to draw it.
To draw it.
Absolutely. Twice as long as it takes them to read.
Darn it, you told everybody.
Can I tell a little story?
Please, yeah.
It's in the book, actually. But anyhow, as a kid in the mailroom, the guy had worked there for a long time, and I worked in a cage right next to this thing. And this guy kept after me to draw his picture. He'd draw my picture. And I said, I haven't got time. And one day I was there working on a Saturday and trying to catch up on correspondence stuff. He said, now you could draw my picture, couldn't you? And I finally thought, okay. I said, okay, sit down. I said, you know, it'd take me about half an hour to draw a picture. I don't do them real fast. You know? And he said, that's all right. I said, okay, sit down. He says, you mean me sit down for half an hour while you draw me? And I said, yeah. He says, I don't have that kind of time.
Well, he was running the mailroom. That's
sorting envelopes in the mailroom.
If he's running the mailroom, he's got plenty of time.
I can't do that. I haven't got that kind of time.
Jack, what do you have?
I have a Herblock cartoon here, which goes along with what Herb was talking about with McCarthy. The last McCarthy cartoon you handed me was published 2 months before I was born.
Oh, really?
I wasn't too familiar with it. But this one goes along with what Herb was saying about how Eisenhower just kind of like sat back almost in fright of the man. And here's McCarthy standing in front of Ike with a cleaver in his hand. And here facing him is, you know, Ike is pulling out of the scabbard of a sword as if where the sword would be is coming out of feather. And he's saying, have a care, sir. And it's just everything. It's right there. You don't even need six seconds to draw
feather,
this.
Yeah,
it's just
uh-huh.
a feather. There's another one here that I'm looking at. It's called titled Richest Country in the World, and it shows these two skyscrapers, and in between them, these two rich, opulent, crisp-looking skyscrapers is a little shack of a schoolhouse with kids crowding into it, and all this traffic is driving by as if they're not noticing. And it speaks so well of what the public school systems around the country today. However, you look at the date of this cartoon, it's September 8th, 1953, and these cartoons hold up, you know, when you're dealing with the issues of education and stuff like that.
The Eisenhower administration.
Still strong.
He had to be pushed to schools for aid to education.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Yeah. Can I mention one about Jack Higgins here?
Yeah, please.
Really, I hadn't seen before. It's an envelope from Congressman Dan Rostenkowski, Washington, D.C., addressed to John Dolas, and so on, 50 Constitution Avenue, Chicago, Illinois. And the whole thing is almost all covered with stamps, and the stamps go on beyond the envelope. You know, and this, it reminds you immediately of this stamp problem in Washington and his connection with it, and it just goes.
That needs to be.
Oh, thanks.
Some of our listeners may not understand that reference, though, because part of the hustle he was engaged in, if he was engaged in any hustle,
mm-hmm. right.
we don't yet know because the investigation has not yet been undertaken. But the mm-hmm. accusation is concerning stamps.
Yeah, if he was doing it this way, he would have tons of stamps out there that he'd have to get rid of.
But this thing is in the shape of a gun. The stamps.
Oh, it's a metaphor I never thought of. Yeah,
that's great.
Thank you.
I was trying to remember. We're talking about symbols. We've talked about this before. That is Dick and Jack on some earlier program. And indeed, 30 years ago. It happened only a week ago, 30 years ago, namely the assassination of John Kennedy. And weren't we remembering once, was it a Malden cartoon with Lincoln weeping?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
It's the statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial
right.
in
right.
Washington. And he's just weeping. Is that it?
He was bent over.
Bent over,
in the
head
hands,
on arm.
The elbows were on the knees, and he had his hands cupped, and his head was buried in his hands.
Yeah.
And no words.
You didn't need words.
Didn't,
would have been all wrong.
No, not really.
What do you remember?
Malden later said that Nixon wasn't. What am I saying? That Lincoln wasn't weeping, but that he, was overcome.
Just overcome. Yeah.
What was your response? What was your cartoon
what
response?
Did I do? Well, I did two cartoons. One of them, the first one was a quote from him about "Let us go forth to lead the land we love" and so on.
Yeah.
But the second one was a couple of people sitting in front of a TV set, a man sitting in front and a woman and a child turned away, their head turned away and their hand over her head. And the title was "I Still Can't Believe It," and you know, it may seem like a kind of a you know not a dynamic cartoon, except it was the way we felt that you still couldn't believe it even a couple of days later,
like it was a radio show or something.
Yeah,
it really wasn't actually happening.
Yeah, it was unreal.
Yep.
Are there moments that absolutely try the capacities and overwhelm the capacities of a cartoonist?
Well,
some things
so.
That you can't put into a picture?
Well, sure. I think any time there's an assassination or an attempted assassination, you know, Gerald Ford went through it also. And those are tough. Those are tough to do because metaphors really don't work. And
it's interesting that the one that Herb was just describing was not metaphorical. It was a direct representation
it's a message.
Of people in anguish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing about assassinations and disasters like that is you don't get a lot of shots at it. You know, it's generally the one day thing or the next day maybe, and you don't get many chances on it.
No, that exactly right. You get that one chance, and you know the famous saying: "Today's Pulitzer wraps tomorrow's fish." You know.
Oh, gee.
and it really is. I mean, it's a one-time shot. That's all you get at it. And granted, it's multiple images through the paper. I mean, you know, the Washington Post.
Unless you offend somebody. Now, there's a colleague of yours, the other guy who does cartoons regularly for the Chicago Tribune, who managed, what was it, half a year ago, to offend one particular ethnic group. And they were...
the Serbs.
Was it Serbs or Croats? I forget. Serbs, I guess.
I think it was the Serbs, and then, of course, there was...
And they were picketing the newspaper on and off
for
quite some while.
And then there were the four priests...
I forget that one.
Well, the one was saying, you know, what time is the Madonna concert on? And, you know, those are jarring.
That was an allusion to sexual abuse by priests.
Yeah, exactly. All in the timing, because at that point, the pedophile story came out at the same time. And I think it was unintentional. But irregardless, it caused a stir, and a major stir.
Have you ever been picketed for a cartoon you've done?
Not picketed, but phone messages where they block up the phones.
Well, I imagine you all have had that at times.
Yeah. And John Fischetti's famous quote, "You're not a cartoonist until you've had a death threat."
Really? My goodness. I don't know how far one wants to go with that, but have you all had them?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess in one form or another. I remember one time there was some that they asked us, I showed them to somebody, they said, you know, when you hear from this guy, turn it over to the FBI or something. But everybody must get these things.
Yeah, I think so.
One of Johnny Fischetti's famous quotes about our profession was, he says, "In cartooning, you put your ass on the line every day."
John had a way with words.
He did. He really did.
One of the first programs I did on this program was with John. At least it was in the first year I was doing this program, when he did that wonderful autobiography, Zinga Zinga Zinga.
You had, I was fortunate enough to be on that one, and you had Chester Commodore.
That's right. From the
Daily Defender.
From the Defender. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is still active, which is remarkable. Yeah. He's been around quite a while. As a matter of fact, he tried out for the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens.
Is that a fact?
Yeah. And he's still drawing cartoons. Yeah.
I just got a book. I wonder if you know this guy. I forget his name. He's a black man who is a cartoonist, Higginson, something like that, and he left the United States.
Owie Harrington.
Oh, Harrington.
Harrington.
Exactly. Went to France, went to Paris, self-imposed exile.
He's done an autobiography, and they've also issued a book of his cartoons, and I just received both of them from Louisiana State University Press or some outfit.
I haven't seen it yet. There was a symposium, I believe it was Ohio State University, about 2 years ago, where he gave an address there, which was very well received. The guy worked for the New York Daily World. That was one of the papers he worked for.
The cartoons are very good and very strong.
Oh, he's just a magnificent draftsman. And very sharp, biting commentary and stuff. I want to get a hold of the book.
Yeah.
Seems like an interesting
sharp
person.
And biting from the far left. He was, for a while, I gather, an avowed member of the Communist Party.
Yeah, he was. And really biting. He was one of the first that really took on... his enemies. I mean, he took them on with a vengeance and plenty of venom and of course, a lot of response.
Yeah. Do you have to have a certain reserve of significant lifelong anger to be a good cartoonist?
We've all got God-given killer instincts.
I mean, Herb Block seems so gentle and affable a fellow.
But we get it off in our work, in our cartoons.
You get the bile out.
Give him a pen.
You can be
pen.
Nice afterward.
Nice at the parties.
Yeah. To hide the pens.
To look at this delightful man here. And,
well, you guys, Jesus. you know, we all have fun and enjoy what we're doing and stuff. And to be able to say what you want and get it off in a cartoon, that's fine.
It really is.
You make it sound like one of the world's great professionals.
It is. Well, it is. It's you know,
only trouble is you need
guy to be in it. I guess if you guys feel the same way,
extremely fortunate.
Oh, yeah. I'd be happy to undertake it tomorrow myself. Except you need talent, don't you?
Well, come on over, and if you can draw well, I'll break your thumbs.
Yeah.
Well, like a friend of mine, you know, Frank Stansberry. I don't know if you know him or not. They made him an honorary member of the National Cartoonist Society. And he says, golly, he says, I can't draw very well. And somebody way in the back says, that hasn't stopped most of us.
Well, of course, that's not really true. When I think of the three of you, each of you has a very distinctive style, and you just have a wonderful visual language to what you do.
Well, you know, you start out by sketching. You know, I sketch my professors' faces in the borders of my books, and I'm sure you did, and you did.
No, I didn't. I don't think. When I was a little kid, I don't think I was up to doing caricatures of the teachers.
But that's
the only thing that saved me. Yeah. The first guy I did was Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany.
You did that on.
I had seen this, you know, with the
you did that on the side. You did that on the sidewalks. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right.
The one cartoon I remember as a kid, and it might have been Ding Darling, showed the Kaiser taking his pointed helmet off. You know, that spear they had on
the... Oh, sure. I drew that spear.
Did you?
Well, when he took
the helmet off, the head was the same shape.
As
the point. later came along, this Ku Klux Klan member took off his sheet, and, of course, the head was just
the cone head. Yeah,
so that's where the cone heads come from.
Hey, can I mention one of Dick Locher's cartoons?
Please,
we're just looking at him here. He has a couple of very sophisticated women, one of them in a store here looking through her bag, and the woman behind the counter waiting for her, and she's saying, my credit card right here somewhere, driver's license, Smith & Wesson, Colt, Uzi, lipstick, yes, here it is.
Can I ask Herb a question?
No, you're not permitted.
I can't do that.
All right, I'll yield and let you.
All right, thank you, Milt. You did the face on the atomic bomb, didn't you?
Yeah.
Atomic?
Mr. Atom.
Mr. Atom, yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
So you originated that, right after the bomb?
Yeah, and you know, 46, I guess.
Was it 46?
Yeah,
I'm not sure I get the reference here.
Here's the image, Milt. I'll pass this book over to you.
Measuring
right
the earth.
In the upper right-hand corner.
You better pass it over. It's my copy.
Yeah. Well, you might get it back later. But, upper right.
Oh, yeah, of course. I saw this.
Mr. Atom, yeah.
And I do recognize it. It's been used often.
Yeah, that's a powerful image.
And then you got bigger and bigger with the hydrogen bomb. I finally just showed the arm grip hanging.
It's not many cartoonists who actually created a creature, put together a person, an object, that people could readily identify. The only other people that I can think of really is Thomas Nast inventing the image of a Santa Claus, the Republican elephant, and the Democratic donkey. And then Herb came along and created this Mr. Atom with the tape measure there, excuse me.
Just a little heavy water and some uranium. And
yeah,
like that.
Right. Yeah. Stir gently.
It took you 15 seconds to draw.
15 seconds, yeah.
Not many cartoonists have been able to do that and encapsulate the figure.
Who invented Uncle Sam? Do we have any? Was that a political cartoon?
James Montgomery Flagg?
James Montgomery Flagg used himself as the image for I Want You. That was a self-portrait.
But
decking
him out
goes back to Thomas Nast also.
I think before that there was an Uncle Jonathan or something, and a kind of farmer's chin whiskers and all that stuff.
And there was John Bull, the English
Bull, the English character, with the flag on the vest.
Flag on the vest,
And that goes back to Punch magazine. Who the artist would have been, I don't know.
It might have been another delightful image. You had mentioned that Margaret Thatcher was on a week ago. Was it a week
ago? About
2 weeks ago. It showed her wrapped in a tattered Union Jack.
Really?
Nothing else. She had wrapped herself in, clinging to it, and it was coming apart. Those are great images.
Where was this?
Punch.
In Punch.
Well, Punch is defunct, but it's the Punch counterpart now.
Yeah, yeah.
But those are good images.
Oh, yeah.
But this guy here is the David Lowe of the United States.
Oh, really. God.
Well, I like that comparison. Lowe was a British cartoonist also. Of course, of a different period. His main period was during the war. I will never forget a superb cartoon that I saw as a little boy. Indeed, my parents noted it and passed it around the table, and I didn't fully understand it, but it had to do... It was his response to the Nazi-Soviet Pact.
And, oh, yes.
And you have Stalin and Hitler sort of bestriding the world and bowing to one another.
Yeah.
And one says, The scum of the earth,
I presume, right, or something like that. Yeah, and the other one,
and the bloodsucker
like
of the masses, or something.
Yeah.
Remember that card?
That was great.
Superb commentary.
Actually, I think Lowe, in a way, his greatest work was before the war, when he was warning about this stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
After a war starts, and not a, you know, you can do cartoons, but you know, everybody is for the war once it. Yeah. I mean, a thing like World War II, anyhow.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but he was.
He kept forecasting. Going on this thing, hey, you got to stop this guy.
He was flashing the white in the corners.
Yeah,
he
really
nobody was paying attention to him, really, until it became too late.
Speaking of wars, how did American cartoonists in the main respond to our there were two further wars that we fought after World War II. There was the Korean War, which in the main, I guess, America accepted, and then there was the Vietnam War. How did American political cartoonists respond to the Vietnam War? Were they at first accepting of it and only eventually disenchanted, or were they opposed from the beginning? How did you respond?
Well, I went along with it at first, and, you know, it began with Eisenhower sending some advisors, and then Kennedy sent more advisors, and that was the first American deaths in Vietnam while Kennedy was president, and so on. Well, the paper worked for the Washington Post. Stuck with the President Johnson all the way, and they were for the war, I think, all the way. And I think I got disenchanted around 1965, and we had a division there, the cartoons going one way and the editorials another.
Really?
But
with any trouble?
I think most
from...
of us at the beginning, you know, thought, well, okay. And it was a matter, you know, you had communist Russia, communist China, and all this stuff, some of us remembered World War II and felt you got to stop these things early, you know. And
do you remember what one of your first cartoon statements against the war was?
Well, one of the first was Johnson talked about we have our position hasn't changed any, and he it showed just a picture of him on an escalator telling this guy that, but the escalator's going up.
That's in the book,
and
yes,
that was in the book, and that's the Johnson technique. And he described his own technique. He said it's like first putting a hand on a girl's knee. You know, he wanted to. He was going to gradually escalate this thing, and he did.
Just the other day, ran across someplace the question: why does a Frenchman always greet a woman by kissing her hand?
That's in my book.
Is that where I saw that?
Yes.
And the answer is,
you have to start.
You have
somewhere.
To start someplace. I just ran across it the other day. That's where I ran across it. I read too many books at once, to be clear about the source. We've got a pause. Some commercials coming, and we will get on to the telephones. We'll open the lines right now. Any questions about political cartooning and directly about politics, including the contemporary political scene? We haven't talked much about this political moment, though you're all reading the papers closely. Indeed, Herb is on the scene in Washington and talking to a lot of the principals, I imagine, whenever he's willing to give them the time.
exactly.
We need to talk about all of that and about some of the opportunities you've found for cartoons only within the last month or so. The phone number is 591-7200, 591-7200. We look forward to your calls. Anything that pertains to American politics, the history of American politics, and, of course, present American political cartooning and the history of American political cartooning. We could also, I suppose, talk about Italian cuisine, but we probably won't. We'll be directly back after these words.
This is WGN Radio Chicago, and you're listening to Extension 720. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we go directly back in an instant to Herb Block, Jack Higgins, and Dick Locher. Six Pulitzer Prizes between them, or as the caller apparently suggested earlier, among them. Between refers to two people. If you've got three people, it's among rather than between. At any rate, our phone number is 591-7200, 591-7200. Some lines are available. We'll get to the phones in just about 2 or 3 minutes. 591-7200 and 312, the area code if you're calling long distance. Listening very closely to what you guys have just been saying during that last commercial break, I've come upon a wonderful quiz question. What's the difference between political cartoonists and baseball players? Do you know the answer?
No, I don't.
Political cartoonists can't remember what they did last week when it comes to their work. Baseball players remember just about every pitch of every game they've ever played in.
That's right.
At least I've discovered that in talking to baseball
players.
That's
right. Yeah.
And one of the movies had somebody asking somebody about something when he used to be in baseball. Oh, it's something I don't remember. It just happened on August 16th at 2:30 p.m. on such a day that I struck out this guy. You know?
One famous night on this program, we had Bob Feller and Lou Boudreau.
Oh, grief.
Boudreau was the manager of the Cleveland Indians when Feller was one of the greatest pitchers in the history of American baseball for the Cleveland Indians. And they replayed some famous World Series game, pitch by pitch, disagreeing about one or two things, whether it was two balls and one strike when the guy did the hit, or whether it was one ball and two strikes. You know, it was just amazing.
You think that we sit over something for 3 or 4 hours drawing it, we would remember it.
Well, that's what I'm about. So that's the phenomenon I want to come back to. Is it really true that you don't remember what you drew 2 or 3 days ago?
Yeah, because we're moving on. We're looking at the next thing on the schedule. The next cartoon, you're already working on it.
Yeah, these cartoons are like grapes. I mean, they're spoiled in about, tomorrow they're spoiled.
But you, of course, also, Dick Locher, draw Dick Tracy, as well as your political cartoons. Do you remember Dick Tracy's adventures?
No, I don't. I can't look. I cannot remember what I did in Dick Tracy yesterday. Isn't it funny? I have to pick up the paper to find out.
How he does both of them, I don't know. The editorial cartoons and Dick Tracy 7 days a week. Wow.
I work with a lot of villains, Herb.
Oh, boy. Well, so do all of us.
In both categories.
Prune face.
You've given me tonight, every time you come here, it's the reason I invite you so often, you give me a Dick Tracy cartoon with reference to me. And here I've got Dick Tracy. You just handed this to me tonight, and it's going to be framed like all the others. Dick Tracy talking into his... used to be the wrist radio. It's by now the wrist television.
The wrist disc.
The wrist disc. And he's saying, don't interrupt me now with the prune face caper, Chief. I'm listening to Milt on Extension 720. I love it.
He can pick that up on his wrist disc.
Yeah. That's great. What's really interesting or agitating or otherwise bemusing you with regard to the current national political scene? Jack Higgins.
Right now, not a lot amuses me because
I didn't say
amuse,
I said bemuse.
Bemuse. Right now, the last cartoon I can remember drawing was one that ran actually Thanksgiving Day, and it showed a turkey about to get its head chopped off. And there's a guy, a man with an axe standing next to the turkey. There's the chopping block, and the turkey's looking at the chopping block, and there's a sticker on the chopping block that says, axes don't kill turkeys, turkeys kill turkeys.
Oh, God, that's wonderful. That's great.
And I was very happy because I usually dislike doing holiday cartoons because they'll never quite work, and I was so happy I came up with that late in the afternoon. I thought, good, I can get it in and draw my Friday cartoon.
I mean, otherwise you would have to have done something rather sentimental, which you didn't want to.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like then it's like a throwaway cartoon. Uh-huh. I think you can do that on Christmas, but Thanksgiving,
you know what's
if you use an axe on Thanksgiving, you may as well make use of the axe, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. What's amazing about this, he remembered it.
I thought of it during a commercial break.
But whether you put it in a cartoon or not, how do things look? You're sitting right there in the middle, and all sorts of people come talking to you, Herb, and they also fear you. Some people have reason to fear you. What do you see going on right now with this current administration?
You asked us to think of a cartoon. Let me tell you, I thought of a cartoon I did a little before Thanksgiving, I guess.
Great.
Anyhow. It was on this Bosnia thing, and I've come back to it from time to time because I think it's kept getting worse and worse ever since the Bush administration and this administration and everything. And I had a couple of guys talking. They didn't represent any particular country, but looking like a couple of kind of prissy diplomats. And one of them was saying, it looks like a very tough winter in Bosnia. Well, we really ought to send them something. And it shows what they're going to send them. It shows a bunch of shovels and a little tombstone markers, here lies, you know, which is,
those are heavy.
That situation bothered me all the way through it. And, I don't understand why, you know, we can't do more than we're doing, can't all do more than we're doing. Yeah.
It's a tough one. I showed Clinton in a military uniform in a swamp, and the whole swamp is covered over with underbrush and that type of thing. He lit a match, and he's looking at the sign, and it says Bosniam.
That's great. Great.
I like that.
Well, is he or isn't he, or are we or aren't we?
I think they kind of get spooked by the Somalia thing. It's like the Vietnam syndrome. Now it's the Somalia syndrome. But Somalia and Bosnia are really, I think, two different things. One of them is a case of aggression against a country that we recognized and all that stuff. And Somalia, a bunch of Warlords
that we can't find.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But interviewed by
But the interviewer, yes, yeah. just yeah, what right. you said, Dick.
We'll send over our SWAT team of reporters.
In all the years you've been in Washington, Herb, have you had a sense that the nature of American politicians has changed? I spoke before you guys came in when I did my first introduction to the program. I spoke of...
You were of the outstanding, great senators like Paul Douglas and Phil Hart. And some people like that. But on the other hand, you don't have these terrible racist demagogues that you used to get from the South, the Bilbos and Talmadges and people like that, who really, on the floor of Congress, they talk racist and bigotry and stuff. And, you get some very good senators from those states now. And so it's been maybe lost some of the real good ones, but on the whole, I think the general quality has improved. That plus... as we've all recognized, the kind of breakdown of the party system, where it's every man for himself now, and you put out your own TV things, and some of them don't even mention party affiliation anymore.
What about the current bunch? What about the White House?
Well, I think Clinton is trying to take on some big subjects. I think health insurance, I think, is a big thing. I'm for it, but everybody's going to argue about what's the best kind of universal health care, I guess. And... he's been good on some other things. Standing up to the gun lobby. When you mentioned this turkey thing about turkeys.
Turkeys killing turkeys.
Of course, the NRA, their slogan is, sure, and so on. And somebody said recently that
turkeys.
guns don't kill people, bullets kill people.
George Bernard Shaw. He knows nothing and he thinks he knows everything. That points clearly to a political career.
Yes, exactly.
It's a line from Major Barbara. Or Auberon Waugh. I seem to be using English people more than others. That's because the book I opened was an English book, I guess. It is my settled opinion after some years as a political correspondent that no one is attracted to a political career in the first place unless he is socially or emotionally crippled.
Oh, gee.
Good grief.
That's pretty tough stuff.
Yeah, that is
tough. Yeah, I think so.
Well, I wonder, though, do really successful politicians, they all have to have some skill in making, in flattering or knowing people and doing favors for people and somehow ingratiating themselves, but do they really feel in contact with other human beings? I will never forget, and I've told this story before, how I once interviewed Hubert Humphrey, who, Lord knows, was very voluble and spoke endlessly and was an interesting, sometimes a funny man.
Yeah.
And we did an interview, and it went swimmingly, though I felt he was unrolling cassettes that he had stored in his head, but he knew how to unroll them as if it was new stuff. And since I was quite amateurish about this sort of thing and was kind of stuck for something to ask as our tape was running out, I went for a last question. I said, who are your friends? And the man blanched and stuttered and couldn't really talk. And finally blurted out, Judge Miles Lord in Minnesota. We went to elementary school together. And later on, I mentioned it to a well-known Washington political writer, Myra McPherson, who used to be at the Post, I think, right?
She did, yes.
And Myra said, you just caught them unawares. None of them have friends. They just use people. There are lots of people that would like to think they are their friends, but they don't really have friends. They have, people are instrumentalities rather than ends for them. Mm-hmm. Now, that might have been far too hard on her part. It's the sort of thing that George Bernard Shaw is saying in a way, too. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Gee, if you asked any of us just suddenly, who are your friends or your best friends, you might have to think a minute and think, so. I wouldn't want to offend somebody else. It might be kind of hard to just... It's a question, I think, if it was suddenly asked, you might be stopped by it.
And I think it's more important to people for themselves to know who their friends are than for other people to know who their friends are.
You're giving me another interpretation of Humphrey's response. But quite apart from the question of Humphrey, do you find a certain kind of cold and calculating quality about really successful politicians?
Well, I don't know. They have to make some compromises. You can't just get up there. As somebody said about Eisenhower when he ran for president, he's going to find out he's not a general anymore. He can't tell people, dude. He's got to ask them.
Harry Truman said that.
Harry Truman said that, yes. And so they all make compromises. They used to say about Roosevelt, that he was a sailor who used to know how to tack into the winds. In order to go somewhere, he'd go left and right and zigzag, right. You know, until he got there. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you have to do that. But I don't think that means that they're insincere.
Gentlemen, let's begin to take some telephone calls. The number is 591-7200, 591-7200. We've got some space available on the board. If you want to call, now is the exact moment when you should be moving to your phone. 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. My question is, I'm wondering if the panel could tell of any specific political action or result that happened from their cartoons.
Some political change that...
Political change or specific action, yes, as a result.
Well, I can mention a definite one. It wasn't mine, but there was a cartoonist for the Dallas Herald. The editorial board had agreed that the city should have unmarked police cars. And he says, no. This cartoonist says, absolutely no, no. He says, you know, they could stop a woman on a lonely road and that type of thing. And he won.
Oh, he did?
He won, absolutely. They reversed their policy.
He did it in a picture or?
In a cartoon.
What was the cartoon?
Well, the cartoon was that, you know, it showed not a legitimate cop, but he had the blue lights flashing and everything else, and he was an absolute devil, a demon coming out of the car late at night. And it was makes powerful sense. and was a definite change. That's that comes to mind first.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you of a cartoon I never drew. I read about it in a book that Alton Miller had written about Harold Washington, where they had spent $1 million putting together an advertising campaign for Chicago, and the title was Chicago City on the Roll. And Harold Washington canceled the whole thing because he had this fear that I was going to go and draw a cartoon on the city and Harold and a roll or something like a sweet roll or something like that. And I thought, I didn't even draw anything.
Well, you were
afraid I had Adam Cowd or something.
You were very hard on Harold. You were hard about his avoir du poids, about the fact that he was growing larger and larger. Often when you drew him, you had a vest button popping off.
Yeah. He used to say that I put him in his daddy's clothes. And what was interesting enough, though, was that Vernon Jarrett told me that he used to talk to the mayor about it. The mayor would complain to him. Yeah. And he said, well, you ought to listen to the guy because he's trying to tell you. You're getting way too obese. And reporters would say that they'd see him at political functions, you know, the rubber chicken circuit and stuff, just downing the food and everything else. And you could see him growing bigger by the day. And I'd run into him at, say, an editorial board meeting, and he'd make a remark about it. And I'd look at him, I thought, his clothes were busting at the seams.
And, they were. and his pockets started to show the white insides. You know? And it really was. And it was the same suit.
And
it might have been what killed him. We don't know.
But. Well, I think it did. I think it did, unfortunately.
Well, he had
it. And it's a legitimate thing to point out to a guy, too, which is if you're getting way too fat, so much of the city depends on that leadership. And if he's not taking care of his health, the city is affected by that.
Our thanks to the caller, and let's go to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. I have a question for Mr. Loker, and it has to do with a little lighter part of the news than the political things we've been discussing, but it still kind of piques my curiosity. Were you, Mr. Loker, were you doing cartoons for the Tribune back in 1980-81?
Yes.
Okay. There was a cartoon, and I think you're the one who did this. It was a cartoon in the summer of 1981, just before the wedding of Prince Charles and Princess Diana. And basically the plot of the cartoon had to do with the future Princess Diana finding out that Prince Charles had turned into a frog, rather than the other way around, the frog turning into the prince. And thinking now, a dozen years later on that, I'm thinking, did you just do it as a joke, or did you have some sort of premonition that maybe the comment wasn't going to turn out the way we thought it would?
Oh, I'd love to think it was fortune-telling, but it really wasn't. It was a joke.
Well, it was a very good one, and I wish you could have repeated it last year, because it just seemed to be so on the money, and I just remember that cartoon so well. And I remember a lot of your political ones as well. But
well,
I just
you.
Thought I'd like to mention that.
Thank you. You know, some of the more popular ones are the British monarchy.
Uh-huh.
They gain an awful lot of response, letters, and phone calls.
What else have you done lately with the British monarchy?
Well, there was that famous one. You remember when the palace burned down?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Windsor Palace.
The Windsor Palace. They showed the Queen sneaking out with the piggy bank, and the piggy bank said, the monarchy. While all the timbers are falling and crashing around her. You know. There's a lot to do. You know, there was Fergie. And, of course, the rest of the family. It's an unbelievable scene. The British cartoonists must be having a blast over there. And we can still do them here, too.
Oh, yeah.
And they do gain a lot of response.
Herb reminds us in his new book, Herb Locke, A Cartoonist's Life, that William Hale Thompson, when he was mayor of this town, threatened that if the King of England ever came to Chicago, he would...
He'll bust him on the snoot.
Bust him on the snoot.
I'll break his nose.
My kind of guy.
He used to have billboards around town. Throw away your hammer and get a... Throw away your hammer and get a horn. William Hale Thompson, mayor.
He wasn't he the one that also says, get away from that wheelbarrow. You don't know anything about machinery.
No, I didn't know.
In the early part of your book, there are some really quite nostalgic memories about Chicago in the 1920s and thereabouts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to school here, you know, and went to Senn High School and...
Lake Forest College for two years.
Born and raised in Chicago. Went to Lake Forest College for a couple of years. Worked on the Chicago News, And... you know, very, very happy memories of, those years in Chicago.
How's the town look to you now? Do you get back much?
Not a great deal, no. But, it keeps looking bigger all the time, but it looks awfully good.
It's a good-looking city.
It is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Some commercials coming, and then back to the telephones. 591-7200. If you've got any things you'd like to see a cartoon done on, you can offer up your ideas. Three of the best cartoonists in the country are sitting here right now. Maybe you'll sell them an idea. 591-7200. We'll be right back after this.
Once again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And we go directly back to the telephones. 591-7200, the number. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask the panel if they think that color is in the future of political cartoons. And would any of them really like to use it?
Well, there was a time when color was in the cartoons on the front page of the Tribune.
Of the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
They were watercolor renderings, and the first of the month was always a calendar, Cartoon Illustrated. But that didn't last very long.
No. Down in St. Petersburg, Clay Bennett does, I believe, Sunday color cartoons. And in Cincinnati, Jim Borgman, I think, does Sunday colored cartoons also. Mm-hmm.
Does he color them, or does somebody else color them?
I don't know. I never asked him. I assume because they have just such a sort of like a touch, like a watercolor or a marker touch that he could put on it, that it's probably his own. And since Clay Bennett does very precise kind of like cutouts of tone shaded stick-on objects to put on the cartoons, add shading, that he probably uses the amberlith, which is like the 3 or 4 color process that, that you can use. So.
Yeah. I think color can be real effective in a cartoon if you use it like a poster. But what so many of them do is just to put a flesh tone on the face and a blue suit.
And a pale yellow, and they let it go at that, and they look terrible.
Yeah, they look terrible.
Well, it reminds me of like Herb's cartoon, 1,000 Points of Light, where he shows 1,000, the caption is 1,000 Points of Light, but he has all these guns shooting off. And the whole picture is gray, but you can see the flashes of the gun shooting. And I think in a similar way you can use color, where you could use the color and then you just have an object in the cartoon that's not in color.
Yeah, that's it. You could do wonderful
postery
things.
Right, like you're saying, a poster type effect.
But I'm against it, though. It's like colorizing black and white movies. I don't like it.
Exactly. It takes away that impact. The color gets too distracting. The people get caught up too much in the drawing. And the drawing is just a messenger. It's not the work of art that should be appreciated, but what you're trying to say.
It's true elsewhere in the paper, too. You know, the New York Times is going crazy with color right now, all over the place. And I find it very distracting and annoying. I'd much rather it remained a black and white publication.
Yeah, remember when USA Today first came out, the description was, it looks like an explosion in a paint factory.
I just reminded myself, when I mentioned the New York Times, though they print lots of the best cartoons of the week in the News in the Week section, they don't have a daily cartoon at all. They may be the only American paper that doesn't.
Yeah. Well, they used to have David Seavey there.
They did?
Yeah, and I think his...
Doing what?
Political cartoons. And he left there, I think, about maybe at least 7 or 8 months ago. I don't know why, but I think his chore was more of sort of like that he illustrated the editorials. Wasn't that it, Herb?
Yeah, I don't remember.
It wasn't a real
cartoon, actually, except... Years ago, a guy named Marcus on the Sunday paper did a...
Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. You're talking about the New York Times. New York Times. For some reason, when you said, when Dick said USA Today, I was thinking USA Today. Yeah.
But remember what Chester Gould said about the cartoon in the New York Times?
No.
He says, think how good they would be if they had one.
Oh. Well, somebody...
That's a good line.
Attributed to an earlier New York Times editor or publisher saying, we don't want any cartoons because in a cartoon you can't say on the one hand and on the other hand.
Exactly right. Like the editor in Florida says, my columnists, he says, that throw pebbles at my window at night. He says, but the cartoonist throws that one big rock right through my living room.
Have any of you, I suppose all of you, have had serious run-ins with the editor who bugs you for saying...
If there wasn't a disagreement from time to time, you wouldn't be doing your job.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you're out there beating the bushes. And they don't always agree. But with the editorial board, it's a policy. You agree to a policy, and if you don't, a lot of times it doesn't go on the editorial page.
And you are each of you members of the editorial boards of your own papers.
Yes.
No.
You are not.
No, right? I'm not. I escaped from that. This is the advantage of having been in as long as I have, probably. But they finally reached a point where they said I didn't have to submit sketches. Just go ahead and draw it and send us a copy of it, which I do. And occasionally there's differences, but they say. It's a signed piece of work.
I'm catching on to something here. And is it the case that for Jack and Dick, you've got to submit the sketch to the editorial board before you publish?
No, we really don't. My editorial board at the Tribune, if you sit in on the meetings, you're going to know what's going on, and you draw to that. And no, I do not do sketches, but they check my spelling. I am the world's worst speller.
Yeah, I have to show the sketch. I think part of that is just they don't want me to go and draw something so incredibly wild and come back at me and say, well, Jack, that's not how you describe it, and have me say, well, I guess I didn't describe it well.
I don't know. I think you would that would be a good way of going. I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, but it helps. It doesn't surprise them, but at the same time, I'd really enjoy just being able to get the cartoon out and not have to wait for the 10 o'clock meeting and just be able to go on with it and get it done.
We go back to the phones. Here's the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to know if your panel ever heard of a cartoonist in Orlando, the Orlando Sentinel, Len Bruden.
Not me.
No. No.
I think I've heard the name. I don't know. I'm not familiar with this.
Well, he's
editorial cartoonist?
He was a political cartoonist on the front of the Orlando Sentinel, a color cartoon.
No, I'm afraid.
For many, many years.
How long ago?
Oh, well, at least 20 years ago.
Right now, Orlando has Dana Summers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are lots of great cartoonists who've gone on to the grand drawing board in the sky or whatever.
Yeah.
Reward they go to. We mentioned John Fischetti earlier. Thank you, ma'am, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Who are some of the others that live in memory?
Oh, well, we were talking about Ding Darling before.
Yeah,
Herb said that he was an idol, and he's also an idol of mine. I grew up in Iowa, and of course the Des Moines Register would show up on the doorstep. Oh, my dad said, look at this cartoon. And they were always good. Ding Darling was fabulous.
He was a wonderful cartoonist.
He really was. Draftsman, and always had a message.
Yeah.
He was excellent. Of course, John Fischetti was one of my favorites of all time. And I have to hark back to strip cartoonists, too, because I was influenced by Chester Gould. Powerful blacks and great perspective.
Yeah.
And,
Which shows not only in your version of Dick Tracy, but shows in your political cartooning. Powerful blacks, as you say.
Well, I like to use that. You know, if you look at the editorial page, it's a mass of gray.
Yeah,
and I want the cartoon to be something a little different, and so I insert the black.
Yeah. I'm very fond of, as a strip cartoonist, Doug Marlette, and I gather he now does daily political cartooning as well.
I think he does, with Newsday.
He does cartoons with Newsday, and then he does Kudzu for the Tribune.
So. I think he did the editorial cartoons first, and then began the
strip. Is that so?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it was some paper down in North Carolina, I think.
Charlotte Observer.
Yeah.
Who are some of the ranking figures, apart from the three sitting at this table?
Mike Peters.
Paul Zepp.
Jeff McNally.
Here at the Tribune.
Don Wright.
Yeah. Jim Borgman. Jim Morin in Miami. Let's see.
We've got some young
Stuart Carlson up in Milwaukee is really good.
Yeah. How many of you are there at all in the country, would you
say? Well, I don't know how many there are, but let me mention something and see if you guys agree. It seems to me that there may be a diminishing number of newspapers, but there's more cartoonists on small papers than I ever saw before.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Papers that complain about they're not making money anymore, but they can afford cartoonists
now. The cartoonists can be...
Well, they can afford cartoonists.
Does it illustrate their own policy or whatever it is?
Like Springfield,
artists.
Illinois.
Yeah. And all over the country.
Yeah.
And instead of using just syndicated cartoons, they might use our stuff on the op-ed page or something.
Right.
But a lot of them... Little papers have their own cartoonists now.
Yeah. And that's great.
Some of them very
well, they
good.
Realize the Absolutely. Immediacy and the impact of a local cartoon. All politics is local. And I think what they also can do with that cartoon is like there's one guy that's down in, I think it's Alton, Illinois, Glenn McCoy. And he draws for the paper down there. Mm-hmm. And he does art department work. He'll do layout and stuff like that, illustrations. Mm-hmm. And then he'll do the political cartoon. Mm-hmm. About 3 or 4 days a week.
Yeah, they have to do the lettuce ads to qualify to do the editorial.
Right.
Which is, I mean, you know, they all start. You got to start somewhere with kissing the hand. And they work themselves up, and they become very good.
Some of them are awfully good.
They really are.
You hardly see them ever, just once in a while reprinted somewhere, and you think, hey, this guy's good.
In the days before the Cold War ended and before communism collapsed in Eastern Europe, there were political cartoonists in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union and in other Eastern countries. Mainly what they did was attack the West. They essentially delivered the party line. Have you been in touch with them? Have you looked at their work? Has it changed much since?
Well, I was in Moscow 3 years ago, and we met with some cartoonists. A lot of what they did, and let's see if you agree with me on this, Dick. You'd look at it, and some of it was just... gags, sometimes not really attacking the system because that's about what they could get away with over there.
Right.
That's what they would allow them to publish.
Poor plumbing.
Right.
And no hairdressers.
And bureaucrats.
Yeah. And bureaucrats.
Everybody has bureaucrats.
It's, yeah.
Even when you couldn't criticize the top men.
Right.
We tried an exchange with the Russian cartoonists before the wall went down.
Really? Yeah.
And we were partially successful. We got the first shipment in and everything went dead. And apparently ours were not adequate for their consumption, but we were delighted to see how they felt about their countries.
Well, I had a similar experience, Dick, when Khrushchev was coming over here and there was kind of a warming up, you know, when Eisenhower was president. And Crocodile, the Russian magazine, asked a few of us here and in England and elsewhere to send them cartoons to run in Crocodile. And I said, well, I couldn't do a new one, but I had one that showed Eisenhower and Khrushchev, you know, with their fingers crossed and waving and so on. You know, it was kind of a hopeful cartoon, I thought.
Yeah.
And, geez, they didn't like it. And I didn't realize at that time they couldn't caricature the head of the government.
Yeah, the government
you couldn't draw him at all, even in a favorable way.
Yeah.
And then they said they wanted some... I said, well, you pick out something. So they picked out cartoons about American slums and stuff that I thought was wrong here.
Yeah.
And I said, no, those don't suit me, and ended up using nothing.
Yeah.
But that's lightened up. And I know since then, Russian cartoons have come over here. And I noticed now they sell the masks of
Yeltsin,
and Gorbachev and all that.
You even had the Gorby dolls over
the
there,
Gorby
too.
Dolls. Yeah,
you opened up and
over.
Keep opening
right.
them up.
Yeah.
But aren't the papers now on a commercial venture? I mean, they have to make money now, don't they?
I don't know enough about it. I know recently I heard that Yeltsin was clamping down on papers that were too critical.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe we haven't changed
but it's,
yet.
But at least they can draw their part of their country's leaders now, which they couldn't do before.
Yeah. We were over there. We were at Pravda, and we did have a chance to meet with their editorial board.
Yeah.
And we were showing cartoons around with an interpreter. And the question came in, why are you so critical of your leaders in the United States? And they said, well, a lot of times we don't agree with what they're doing. Why don't you do that over here? Well, we don't have to because they're perfect.
Yeah.
And then there was the big wink.
I remember somebody saying, an American talking to somebody in the Soviet Union while that was still in existence, and saying, you know, in the United States we have freedom. We can say that... you know, President Bush is President Eisenhower is no good. And he says, we have freedom here. We also can say President Eisenhower is no good.
We've got to stop. Last quick round of commercials, and there is some space on the board again for additional calls. If you have been trying to reach us, do try again. If it occurs to you for the first time, do give us a call on 591-7200, 591-7200. Before we go to the last batch of commercials, I should tell our listeners that you will be signing books tomorrow, Herb.
Yes.
At Stuart Brent's bookstore right here on Michigan Avenue. That's at 4 p.m.
Right.
4 p.m. till your hand grows tired.
Okay.
All right. So, to get a copy of the new book by Herb Bloch, namely Herb Bloch, A Cartoonist's Life, published by Macmillan, you can get it autographed, all for the same price, apparently, at Stuart Brent's tomorrow, 4 o'clock on. We'll be directly back after these words. What are you whispering about? Now, we're on the air, but I want you to go on doing what you're doing.
The new use for editorial cartoons, I think it's delightful. They're put on computer screens so they don't burn out the screen. And there's a new message every day.
Do they burn the people that watch them?
They probably do. That's the point. I find that fascinating.
Well, it's like those images they have in the graphics department.
Yeah, they'll show swirling.
You know, swirling stars, planets.
Yeah, that's screen set. Yeah.
I watch these guys in the graphics department, but they work in these computers. I figure one of these days those computers are going to start drawing the cartoons. You know? We're all going to be downsized.
Yeah.
I imagine there is already some kind of software that would do something like that for you.
Well, they,
you
know, they animate cartoons by computer now. You can make the hands and arms, the arms and legs.
I imagine a duffer like me who can't draw could find a way of giving an order to a computer if it's got the right software in it and say,
draw me
a Bill Clinton, put a hat on him of such and such a variety.
And add sound.
But it lacks one thing, which is spontaneity, although you can be spontaneous, but that artistic mistake where you have a slip of the hand and then suddenly you say, God, I don't think I've ever drawn Clinton that way and never will be able to either, because you make that beautiful little mistake that you can never make but with the human hand.
Yeah.
And I think once we start drawing people on computers, who are we to be criticizing people? Because then we're less than human. We're not using our human capacity.
A lot of people think we're less than human already. Jack.
But not cartoonists.
Frankenstein. They add the hand and the head, and the rest is up to you.
I think you got to be hands-on if you're a cartoonist, though. Just as if you're strangling one of these guys, you got to use your hand.
In artistic style, you guys are all caricaturists to some degree as well. When you represent politically prominent persons, you kind of do them larger than life, don't you?
Oh, yeah. And as I say, you know, you get your opinion into the way you draw them, sure. David Lowe talked about drawing people, and he said there was some guy that had a formula. This was before computers, but he had a different dozen different noses and different things, and he was going to put people together from these different things. And, you know, Lowe's point was, what you emphasize is not the similarities, but the differences between people.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But, well, you know, the lifeblood is the message of the cartoon. I mean, you got to have the message first. You can have the best drawing in the world without an idea. It's nothing, really. Mm-hmm. It's got to have a message.
Have there been some great cartoonists who aren't particularly good draftsmen?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's draftsman so much as style. You know, you take Wayne Stasko from the Tampa Tribune, for example.
Mm-hmm. He used to be here at the Tribune.
He was at the Tribune and the Chicago American at one time. And the style is quick, fast, furious, and dirty, and, you know, might take him a half hour or two.
And his caricatures were so simple, yet I think that he was one of the best caricaturists in the country.
Like Jane Byrne.
Jane Byrne. It looked just like her.
Nobody could draw Jane
Byrne.
She
didn't have to look in a mirror in the morning. All she had to do was look at his cartoon.
Let me ask you something.
You said about a half an hour. Did he draw these things that fast?
Yep.
That's awfully fast.
He came in at 6 in the morning, and he was on his way home by 7.
You are kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
It's a beautiful drawing. That fast style. It looked fast, but I didn't know it was.
Lichtenstein,
some of these guys, well, Jules Pfeiffer will draw it once, but it's the sixth time he's drawn it. I mean, he'll draw it on these sketch lines, but he's done it 6 times before and tried it out to get it right.
Possibly with an overlay.
Well, let's do a survey here. How long does it take to do a typical Herb Bloch?
Well, I'd say about 3.5 hours. But
to do the drawing itself?
Yeah, do the drawing itself, the final drawing. I was telling Jack, you know, I'll take all available time, like all available space. If I got 6 hours, I'll fool around and take 6 hours. If I
that's Parkinson's law.
I did one once in
Parkinson's law. It applies to you.
12 minutes. Parkinson's law, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Work expands
but
to fill available.
If he's got a room, he's going to fill it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I
yeah, that was in the book.
But 3 hours for an average Herblock.
Three and a half. Yeah.
How much time for an average Higgins?
It really depends on the content of the cartoon. If there's a lot of pruning involved, and I can't stand pruning, it'll take a little bit longer, but it'll take anywhere from 2 to 3 to 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I've been surprised at cartoons that have a lot of detail. Sometimes I can get them done in about 3 hours. Then some that are very simple, I'll realize I'm practically dumping every available jar of ink on them and correcting them. So...
Have we hit the norm here, Dick? Yeah. Are you about a three-hour man?
It's 3 hours, yeah. And with a lot, you know, I put a lot of words in a cartoon. One time my editor said it's too short for an editorial, too long for a cartoon.
Oh, no. I think a good cartoon is a good cartoon. Yeah. There's a lot of words or a few words, whatever.
Exactly. Well, for example, I think this sums it up rather succinctly. The Chinese asked for an exhibition of cartoons, and the one stipulation was no words. Just the only cartoons you could send over are the ones without words. Yeah. And they wanted their people to get the image fast and quick.
Back to the phones. Good evening. You're on the air.
Milt?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for the excellent program, by the way.
In what way is this night different from all other nights?
Cartoonists, to me, are the commentators on our life. To bring up the example that I'm asking about, I have two of Bill Mauldin's books. Up Front, which is a first edition, and Back Home, which is a second edition. Now, I knew Mr. Mauldin did cartoons for the Sun-Times for a long time, but I haven't heard anything from him since he left the Sun-Times. What happened? Or, if you'll forgive the vernacular, what happened to him?
He retired. He retired.
He's not working for anyone any longer?
No, he's not.
He bought a twin-engine airplane. He's flying all over the country. He really is. He does. Yep. He overhauls his own engines and flies around.
Does he not draw anymore at all? What?
That I don't know. I haven't seen anything that he's had published. The last time he was in our paper had to be at least 2 or 3 years ago.
He was living down in the Southwest, but sending cartoons
right
up to the Sun-Times for years.
Right, exactly. And... he was either faxing them or mailing them. He was trying each to see which had the better reproduction. But, you know, he just reached a point where he just decided to move on. And
well, that raises a fascinating question. He has the mind and the spirit and the soul of a man in his 40s or 30s or even younger. But Herblock is one of our somewhat more senior fellows by now. Still, you keep going every day. Where do you get... the gusto for it, after all.
Oh, you know, I love it. I've been doing it ever since I was 19 years old, or, you know, daily cartoon, yeah. Except for time out in the Army. And, you know, what would I do if I weren't drawing cartoons? I was laid up for a while earlier this year, and after a little surgery, I couldn't wait to get back, you know.
You have to get a job. If you didn't do it, you'd have to get a job, Herb.
Yeah. Who wants to work, you know, when you can draw cartoons?
So the idea of retirement is anathema.
No, that's terrible, yeah.
I feel that way, too.
Good.
Yeah.
Well,
time approaches for retirement, I'm just going to say no.
I think so. When I die, I want to be buried in Chicago because I want to stay active in politics.
That's wonderful. Oh, Dick.
Now, did you make that line up, or is that a standard you borrowed from somebody?
I'd like to turn it into a cartoon, but I don't know how to do it.
Actually, they have a precinct for you. They have a precinct for you.
Have somebody say it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I do.
Do you do much with Chicago? Not much, I think. Not as compared to Jack.
Well, probably not. My boss likes the International.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had discussions on that, sure. I love to do Rostenkowski. That's always fun. And the mayor, of course. You know, it's all fair game. We got the city council. We got the best writers in the world. We got the city council.
I don't like to do Rostenkowski, though. I prefer to do Congressman A.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're fun.
We do have a cast of characters here, and I don't even think these guys realize half the time how funny they are. Our mayor can open his mouth, start talking, and once he gets excited, it's like trying to get a propeller to stop. You just can't do it. He just keeps on going and going and going.
And, you know, that's like the school cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
You just change the faces each year. That's all you have to do.
Yeah.
And you can use the same cartoons over and over and over because we run into this crisis every fall.
Yeah.
Every Saturday I do like a review of cartoons. The first Saturday of every month we run about 3 or 4 of my old cartoons, and then I do like a 4-paragraph summary of what happened in the past. And this September and October, two first series in a month in a row, I did nothing but old school strike cartoons.
Yeah.
And lack of funding and everything else. And the whole point was trying to say that basically they've never cleaned the slate. They've never approached it. They're taking the same approach to this crisis and making the same mistakes with elementary education. And just these things, especially in the local level, they just go in cycles. Nothing really changes.
It's the like the disclaimer at the end of a TV show. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent. You know, that's
what
all
innocent?
We do.
Which innocent?
Yeah, right. Nothing innocent about those guys.
One of the great things about Jack, I think, really, is he's one of the few cartoonists, and you see what you think about this, Dick, on a large city paper who does a great many local cartoons as well as national and international stuff. And I think that's terrific.
It is.
Thank you.
Even having been away from Chicago, I look at these things and I think, hey, that's great.
The Thanks. Chicago ones are so much fun to watch.
Aren't they? Yeah.
They really are. We've got a good scene here. We probably should mention, too, that Jack won in the Fischetti Award this year.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing.
Yeah,
hey, good. Yeah. They weren't Chicago judges this year either. I couldn't buy them.
Say something about the Fischetti competition.
Well, each year. It's our 11th or 12th year, Jack.
12th year.
12th year, and I was fortunate enough to be in on the inception of this thing with Karen. And it's a scholarship funding.
Karen is Karen Fischetti.
Karen Fischetti, John's wife. Yeah. And it's with Columbia College, and each year they do this to raise money for the kids in the journalism class. And it's a nationwide cartoon contest. And we get the cream of the crop, and that's what's kind of fun to see.
Yeah.
And you know, we do this annually in November. Judging is in October, and we've got some super cartoons.
You gentlemen will allow it. I want to take a moment out to talk about a very special program that we've got lined up for tomorrow night. Lots of talk shows, so-called, have undoubtedly been talking about the accusations against the Cardinal and more broadly about the phenomenon of sexual abuse and repressed memories about sexual abuse. I am personally convinced, and I use my vast authority as a psychologist rather than as a talk show host, that the larger portion of such accusations are false memories, very often stirred up by incompetent and or unethical people who call themselves psychotherapists, but in my book would be called something else. Very often, depending upon techniques, those practitioners don't understand at all, particularly hypnosis, which does not necessarily reveal the truth, but makes people very prone to suggestion and cueing by the inadequate so-called therapist. I say all of that because tomorrow night we are going to be doing a very special program on the phenomenon of false memory syndrome. My guest will be Dr. Gary Almy, a psychiatrist with the Loyola University Medical Center here in town, Zachary Bravos, a Chicago area attorney who represents people who've been accused of child abuse, and via telephone, Pamela Fried, who is the founder of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which protects parents who have been falsely accused, and also Henry Gleitman, a leading American psychologist from Pennsylvania, from the University of Pennsylvania, who will shed some further light on these matters. That should be a most interesting conversation tomorrow, and of course, we expect that we'll have some rather strong telephone calls as well. I see that we are virtually out of time, so I do simply want to once again note that the new book by Herb Bloch, is Herb Bloch. Which is the way he signs his cartoons. And Herb Bloch, A Cartoonist Life by Herbert Bloch, is published by Macmillan. And Herb will himself be available tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. at the Stuart Brent Bookstore to meet with those who drop in and, of course, to sign books. Herb, it's been an absolute delight having you here.
It's been a great pleasure for me to be here, Milton.
And I thank you so much. And thanks to our two old friends, Jack Higgins and Dick Loker. And thanks to Dick Tracy as well. And
old friends of mine, too.
Yeah. And with that, we'll close down for the evening with a cordial good night to all.